Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Lane, a host of the channel. With his new book, Back to America, Identity, Political Culture, and the Tea Party Movement, published by University of Nebraska Press in 2019, Professor Bill Westermeyer explores the once powerful Tea Party movement and the changing nature of political culture in the contemporary United States. Through extended fieldwork with local Tea Party groups, he documents the distinctive cultural world of the Tea Party movement and the personal journeys that drew participants to it. Westermeyer identifies feelings of political dislocation and disempowerment among Tea Party members, as well as fears about the perceived decline of the country due to secularization. He addresses issues of race within the Tea Party as well, arguing that simply dismissing the Tea Party as a white supremacist movement misses the complexity of how Tea Party members think about and talk about race. He also considers tensions and differences within and between local Tea Party groups, as well as their varying relationships and degrees of connections to the national Tea Party movement. Ultimately, Westermeyer argues, understanding the Tea Party movement, its popularity, and the cultural world it figured is as crucial today as it was during the party's heyday. For while the Tea Party movement and Trumpism are not the same thing, Westermeyer writes, quote, as Mark Twain might have said, they sure rhyme. I'm excited to be talking today with Dr. Bill Westermeyer, author of Back to America, Identity, Political Culture, and the Tea Party Movement, published by University of Nebraska Press in 2019. In the interest of full disclosure, I should note that I have a personal connection to Dr. Westermeyer's book, as it was published as part of a series I co-edit with James Bielo for University of Nebraska Press on the anthropology of contemporary North America. So, Dr. Westermeyer, welcome to the show.
Hello.
So if you could begin for us, could you just tell me a little bit about yourself?
Yes. Currently, I'm at the University of South Carolina at Aiken. I grew up in Southern California in Santa Barbara, and I received my BA from UC San Diego in political science. After my undergrad years, I actually spent almost 15 years doing political work in California and in many Western states. So I came to anthropology actually late. I started graduate school well in my 30s, actually, and I did graduate school at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So I did research, as we're going to talk about, and now I am at the University of South Carolina.
That's great. So let's talk about Back to America. You write that the book is an effort to make sense of what you were seeing in the Tea Party movement in light of your own political and scholarly experience. So how did you come to this topic in the first place?
Well, coming to the specific topic was actually almost serendipitous. I was interested initially in doing research on ethnographic research on an election by going to a specific part of the country and studying different groups that were coming together for the 2010 election. And I chose a certain area in North Carolina to do it because of the demographics and the economics and When I got there in early 2010, I wasn't finding a lot of political organizations operating where I was, but what I started to run into repeatedly was Tea Party groups. And this was in 2010 as the Tea Party was rising. And in the area that I was working in, I saw all these groups. And talking with my my committee about it, they said, you know, you really need to change your topic here. So I completely revamped it and started working, building contacts with these Tea Party groups in Central North Carolina. And oddly enough, there were very, very few other anthropologists that were actually doing research with Tea Party groups. I only knew of three or four, actually. Now, more broadly, one of the reasons that I wanted to study anthropology after leaving political work was because of what I saw from doing political work. I worked at the grassroots level. I was a political operative, you could say, or and I engaged in a lot of grassroots politics. We called it parking lot politics, a lot of petitioning and canvassing and things like that. And I found in a lot of instances that the more sort of structural and hierarchical politics that I learned about in political science in college wasn't really what I was seeing. I was seeing a lot of culture when I was seeing a lot of cultural understandings, and people's political ideas and their political viewpoints were oftentimes the result of where they were and their lives and other aspects that were that one could unlock by speaking and talking with people over an extended period of time. If I could give you one example of what I'm talking about, I once worked in the state of Utah on an initiative, a ballot proposition to make it more difficult for police to engage in asset seizure during arrests. And I was working in Utah, and my first impression was, well, this is a very conservative state, and these people aren't going to support this because it sounds kind of liberal. But upon getting to Utah and with a large population of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and Mormons, I found that that issue resonated with them because of the seizure of property that they had undergone by the government earlier in the Mormons' history. So actually, they were much more supportive than I would have figured. But I wouldn't have figured that out without actually understanding the experience that those people went through. Sorry. So to make a long story short, what I wanted to do was to engage in understanding politics from this level of culture, of personal histories and the meanings that people attach to political issues.
Well, and that sounds like, in a way, an answer to one of the next questions I wanted to ask, which was what initially drew you to ethnographic research in the first place?
Yeah, I did answer that to a degree. I think let me take it from another direction, though. I also was bothered by political analyses that attribute agency to large, huge demographic groups, and maybe give those groups larger power or influence than they should deserve. For instance, saying, "Well, all of these people are doing this because they're white male Southerners," right? And saying, "Okay, this is what white male Southerners do." And while that can be useful in some regards, I find that there is a lot more complexity to people's political, the path people take to political subjectivities. So that was another reason that ethnographic research is so important, because you're able to spend an extended period of time watching and talking with people to understand the nuance and the differences between different people that may nonetheless have the same demographic position, but also that may look to have the same political positions. But if from the book you see that people come to the Tea Party from very, very different perspectives, and that could not have been uncovered without a very, very sophisticated survey a quantitative survey. So I think ethnographic research is so important for understanding politics.
And so what exactly did your ethnographic research for this book end up entailing?
I began to contact groups of Tea Party activists. So the way that the Tea Party was organized at the grassroots level were what I call in the book local Tea Party groups. And these were municipal level organizations, small local organizations of everyday citizens who met on a regular basis in an American Legion hall or a rented space, or sometimes in a restaurant like a Golden Corral or something like that. And in the area that I was living at the time where I planned to do my research, I was able to very easily contact 8 groups. And I first started by just showing up and telling them what I was doing and asking if I could observe their groups. And I did that for 18 months of going to different group meetings. They're regularly held meetings. I waited a good 6 months of just observing and chit-chatting with people in their meetings. And then I started doing interviews, semi-structured interviews with people after that. I wanted to wait for them to feel comfortable with me. And at that point, I did about 60 semi-structured interviews. And I think I participated in, I think it was 75 or 80 events and meetings that the groups did over the course of about 18 months.
So once you had finished all of that diverse field work, what did the writing process look like for you? How did you go about turning all of that information? Because I can only imagine the page counts of transcriptions and field notes. How did you go about turning all of that into a book?
The transcription was really a nightmare to do. This sort of answers your question in a couple of ways. The first thing I have to say is that being a little older, I sort of was raised in a world where we didn't do everything on a keyboard. So I was raised writing. And so I had to transcribe my interviews by using a voice to text program. So I was literally reading out loud repeating my recordings into a microphone and having them transcribed. So that took a while. So after I transcribed all the data, what I did was I sat down for, gosh, it must have been a week or two, in a coffee place in Chapel Hill, and just read the entire body of research that I had done. I just read everything with a notepad and started writing down themes that were emerging from the data. So I was trying to be inductive about it. I was not trying to say, well, this is, you know, I wasn't trying to validate what I was thinking, but actually grasp theory as I read through the material. So I spent a good deal of time, came up with several themes. I then coded, or actually indexed, all of it using InVivo, analyzed the data, and then did the writing. And as I said, I wasn't raised as a typer, so in the questions you sent me, one part of it says, "Did you write on paper?" Yes, actually, I wrote almost the entire manuscript on yellow legal pads, and then transferred them to text, actually. so that's how we produced the book. It was all in longhand on yellow legal pads.
I like it. I like the old school approach. I don't necessarily write out my entire manuscripts on paper, but certainly the beginning of the process starts there for me always.
Yeah. I found that when I came back to school in my 30s, that I was trying to compose on a keyboard, and everything came out too choppy. And so I just started writing things, and I find it works much better.
So then let's turn to the book itself. In your introduction, you note that your own political positions rarely aligned with those of the people you were studying. And I think that's one of the first questions many people would have about your book, right? Which is sort of how you navigated the political differences and the differences in perspective between yourself and the individuals that you're writing about. So I thought perhaps you could speak a little bit about that.
Yes. Some of my friends some of my friendships that I had while I was producing this would often say, I don't know how you did that. You know, them knowing me and what have you. A couple of ways to answer this. One of them is fairly simple. The other is one that I still ruminate over. First, when I did political work, I often worked on what some people may be familiar with as ballot propositions or initiatives. These are issues that go in front of voters and people vote yes or no on them. So in other words, I was oftentimes approaching voters on single issues. And oftentimes when somebody agreed with the issue I was working on, they may not have agreed on other issues that I might hold dear. And I had to sort of suppress that when I was doing political work. It says, I don't care if your political beliefs I find offensive as long as you agree with this issue that I'm working on right here. And this is a lot of what Saul Alinsky, a great organizer, used to speak of. And so that, I think, was a good preparation for me to do this research because I was very used to sort of putting my own political sensibilities to the side and listening to what people were believing. Now, the other point was more of an ethical problem that I still think about, and that is I didn't want to tell people what my political views were. And I told them that up front. I told them I would prefer not to discuss my political beliefs because I didn't want it to affect the way that you were responding to me. And the reason I think that was important was from the way that I was beginning to understand right-wing populism in America, and that is right-wing populism today has a very strong demonization of opposition. And if I had told people my political views, which are left of center, well, left of center, that they may actually think of me as one, less of a reasonable person, two, that I was maybe some type of a spy who was going to, I had an informant tell me once, Bill, hopefully he's not going to try to make us look like a bunch of idiots. So I was very cognizant of that. And I think the point of this was, what did I produce afterward? Did I produce a piece of work that was fair to the people who I would not be ashamed of showing them the manuscript? And that's what came out. I was honest with the way my people were. And I believe that those two factors made sure that the data I got was good.
Well, and I think that another topic people are immediately going to have when they come to this book, so I figure we'll end up talking more about it later, but we might as well address it head on in the beginning, is that you say that while the Tea Party movement and Trumpism are not the same thing, as Mark Twain might have said, they sure rhyme. So I wondered if you could tease out those parallels a little bit now, just to give us a sense of some of the connections you see, so we can keep them in mind as we talk about the book.
Yes. And actually, part of this is one of your last questions about what I'm actually doing now. And that's one of the questions that I'm working on right now is how did my Tea Party informants become strong Trump supporters? And to answer your question here, I believe that the purpose is to look at the definition of populism. This idea that a group of people are in opposition to an elite. And also that both Trump and Tea Party supporters both feel a sense of stigma in regard to the broader society, that they're sort of people outside of time, maybe, or though I didn't completely agree with this book, the title that Arlie Hochschild had for Strangers in Their Own Land is actually an apt metaphor for how both of these groups feel. And I found that they come from different places, but what they're practicing is very, very similar, a reaction to a sense of stigma. For the Tea Party, it was the sense of stigma of being patriotic and these sort of 1950s values. For Trump supporters, it's being looked at as backwards, rural deplorables. So they're different, but they have a very, very common theme that runs through right-wing populism historically, you know, or populism in general, actually, for the last, 200 years.
Yeah, thank you for that. So to focus in on the people you did meet and talk to, how did they come to the Tea Party movement? Why were they initially attracted to it?
Most of the people that I spoke with during this research had not done political work before, or at least intense political work before. Many of them, though, did have bad experiences dealing with politics or politicians. One of the points I make in the book is a lot of people actually tried to involve themselves in their local county level political party, Republican Party organizations, and found those organizations as very ossified. Several use the term good old boys networks, which I think the gendered description is actually apt, not just because that's kind of a cliche, but they were gendered spaces. And so people didn't feel that they were either welcome or could affect much change. And they also, the local political groups were often run by the elites of the community, you know, the real estate developers and the insurance people. And, you know, so they were often controlled and they weren't really interested in dramatic change either. Secondly, I believe that they were motivated by the emergence of this Tea Party discourse in 2009. I think what I write in the book is that the economic problems of 2008 were very frightening to a lot of people. And Barack Obama came into office. Here was a president that did not look like them. But more so, there were some very comprehensive solutions that Obama was proposing to pull the economy out of recession, which entailed adding, nearly $1 trillion in debt to the deficit. And I was thinking about this and aside from large tax cuts, I don't think America has really seen a large amount of deficit spending for something like this since the Great Society. So a lot of people have not seen this huge amount of spending being done on everything from cash for clunkers to doing mortgages to shovel-ready projects. All those things were going on, and I don't think most people had experienced that since the Great Society of the 1960s. So a lot of people hadn't experienced it in their whole life. So I think people were a little shocked by it. I think people were a little worried. But finally, the other point is that you had Fox News and you had Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck, all of these media sources that they were listening to, energizing them also. And you had the famous, Santelli rant that happened on CNBC in 2009. So I think that there was some angst that people had. I think there was some motivation by media that was going on. There were personal problems that they had with their local party organizations also happening. And then the groups themselves were often formed by a small group of people who knew each other through church or neighborhood or something like that. And they often started a Facebook page. They registered their group with a large Tea Party group called Tea Party Patriots, so people could find them. And they also put little ads in their local newspapers, and people began to show up for these meetings. Some of the groups also sort of started off their organizations by having a tax day protest at their post office or federal building or something like that. And some of these little groups had quite remarkable numbers of people showing up for these protests on April 15th of 2009. So those were some of the things that brought people to the Tea Party movement.
I really like the anthropological eye that you bring to this study. And one of the things you write is that, and I'm quoting you here, anyone observing the Tea Party can easily discern a distinctive cultural world. The Tea Party has created a set of identities, practices, emotions, and symbols that constitute what it means to be a Tea Party member. And that really, that world is what your book is documenting and exploring and helping a reader to think about. So can you describe in general, sort of what did that cultural world look like?
Yes. And you're right. It's a primary theoretical position that I take in the book, and I'm building on the theories of Dorothy Holland, who was a longtime anthropologist at UNC Chapel Hill before passing away earlier this year, actually. The idea of the cultural world, she called them figured worlds, and what they are is they're based on this idea that all of us inhabit cultural worlds, social worlds that encompass activities and beliefs. One way to visualize it is the way that children participate in play worlds, you know, being a fireman or being a doctor. And what they do is they appropriate language and you know, bodily behavior and clothing and, you know, imaginary stethoscope, for instance, or something like that. And they play this world. Well, I think humans do this throughout their lives. And all of us participate in these cultural worlds where we have a language and we have certain jokes and we have certain symbols and ways of holding ourselves and behaving based on these cultural worlds that we either join or recruited into. One of the best examples and one of the ways that I was able to sort of understand this was when I was earlier in college, I spent a lot of years waiting tables. And the idea of the cultural world that you have when you're working in a restaurant, there's different language, there's different ways of behaving, there's your sort of a Goffman front of the house and back of the house behavior that you have. There are things that you could talk about that somebody else completely wouldn't understand. And the Tea Party is this kind of world. People were unsatisfied with the way the country was. And also they were unsatisfied that their way of seeing the world politically and socially was not valued in the society. So the Tea Party formed this world that people could inhabit and operate within for a little bit of time every few weeks. And they could celebrate the founding fathers. They could read the Constitution. They could talk about how American values are going to hell in a handbasket. And, you know, all of these things they could do in these spaces. And it was a world. It was a little social world that people occupied. And I think that's a very important way to look at how, to a large degree, social movements operate. People exist in cultural worlds of the social movement. And this is the basis in which one fashions a sense of political self, you know, a sense of political identity. So for the Tea Party, one would enter this cultural world through, you know, say entering through a local Tea Party group, and there would be the Pledge of Allegiance right off the bat. And then people would say a Christian prayer. And then people would sometimes have a history lesson, or they would talk about one of the articles of the Constitution. They would plan political activities, like what maybe going and sitting in on a board of commissioners meeting. They would talk about how they see American culture, and they would often frame the problems in America. They would frame those things in the context of the cultural world. Well, if America followed the founding fathers, if they followed the Constitution, we wouldn't have these problems. So it was not just a world that one participated in, but it was also a frame in which to value events and people, including me, at one point. So that's how the cultural world operates.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, I'm an anthropologist in an American studies department, so I also sort of accidentally ended up teaching history as well as anthropology. And I was really interested from that perspective. I was interested in your discussion of the ways Tea Party members use historical facts, and you write facts in quotes, and you describe these facts as being deployed sort of as, quote, hidden treasures that buttress their vision of America. And I found that really fascinating, and I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about some examples of those sorts of facts and how they were used.
Yes. Part of I'm going to go off for just a second and explain one thing. I read a book by an historian named Jill Lepore, who wrote a book called "The Whites of Their Eyes," and it was how Tea Partyists use history. And one of the points that she makes is that to a large degree, people in the Tea Party were making the people of the past, you know, the founding fathers, almost contemporaneous with today, and trying to judge how they would act in regards to healthcare reform or something like that. And Jill Lepore found this as a problematic way to look at history because, you know, history changes. You know, you can't, there's no direct analogs between then and now. That's one point. But more directly to your question, there are a couple of really interesting stories. One of them was regarding how God favored the Americans in the American Revolution. Excuse me. So, for instance, there's the very famous story of when George Washington evacuated Brooklyn Heights when he was being driven out of New York by the British. He had to cross, I think it was the East River, He had to cross the East River, and there were British warships in the East River, but there was a fog that night. And Washington was able to evacuate almost his entire army across this river without the British seeing him. And just as he was finishing, the fog lifted. And I heard on a couple of occasions people using that story as indication of the divine providence of the American story, you know, that America favored the American Revolution. So that was one of them. One that was a little bit more problematic was when Tea Partyists often like to say that America was founded as a Christian nation. And one of their ways they support that idea is by saying that most of the founding fathers were clergymen, and that it's a problematic statement. And the reason they say it is because most of the early founding fathers went to college at religious-based institutions, William and Mary or Harvard, and that was all you had back then. So by implying that they went to religious-based universities, that then they were then clergymen. And that's not exactly accurate. So that was another one of those historical stories they used to buttress their point of view, when in reality, it's not actually true. It's not really actually the way things were.
Well, and as you mentioned earlier, social movement participation is a highly personal journey. And you write that people joined the, quote, figured world of Tea Party because they found resonance between it and the personal experiences and beliefs that they already had. And I wondered if you could speak more about that, about the personal resonance, because it sounds like this discussion of historical facts and the way where they were being deployed connects to this.
Yes. This is one of the primary, besides the cultural world, this is the other main takeaway that I want people to have for this book, that in order to understand why people do what they do politically, you have to understand the personal trajectory that they've taken. What have they experienced in their lives that bring them to that place that they are at in the social movement? And I spend an entire chapter with several different people tracing their path to joining the Tea Party based on their earlier lives. And I think my most favorite one in that chapter is the one I do at the end, which was a very pious Christian woman who was a very strong Tea Party supporter. And what her experience was working in the furniture mills in North Carolina in the 60s and 70s. She grew up in the Low Country of South Carolina. So she had been poor her entire life. She was a sharecropper, actually, in the Low Country. And she was very religious. And when I asked her why she joined the Tea Party, she started talking about her the religion of America and how it was being she was talking about how America was secularizing. How, for instance, she said Madeline Murray O'Hare took religion out of schools, which was the woman who filed the lawsuit against prayer in school. And she talked about Roe versus Wade. And in these ideas, she was saying that the government was making America a bad country in God's eyes. And so as a result of that, the Tea Party was her way of bringing God back in, by having the people more active in politics in America. Let's see. Another was a woman who was a man in tobacco country in North Carolina who felt that politics was made up of backstabbing and deal making. And he saw it as inherently corrupt. And he had retired from, he was actually an executive, and he retired and moved back to this area. And he tried to involve himself in some of the local organizations and government bodies and things in the county. And he kept finding people trying to tear him down. And what he said to me was, the Tea Party isn't like that. They're not trying to promise anything anybody. We're just trying to hold people accountable at the grassroots. So he had had this bad experience with politics. He was also remembering an earlier time that when he was growing up in that area, when social relations were much simpler and the economy was much simpler, And he was using that as a mirror almost to understand why he wanted the change that he wanted, or why he was feeling dislocated from politics. So the book is full of a lot of stories of people's personal journey to the Tea Party. And I'm sort of proud of that chapter, because I think it's important for us to look at people's politics that way. We're not just responding to, you know, Fox News or MSNBC and saying, okay, that's what I believe, but we consume it and we process messages through our own lives and then develop political ideas and positions from that.
Well, and definitely the examples you just mentioned touch on what I find to be some of the most interesting sections of the book, right? Which was really coming at this movement from the grassroots, coming from the people themselves and their lives, and what drew them in and what spoke to them about the Tea Party or their interpretation of it. And, you know, those feelings of political dislocation and disempowerment, ideas about religion and what they perceive as a widespread rejection of Christianity in the United States. I mean, those were just really compelling portions of the manuscript. So I'm glad those came up in the examples that you mentioned. Another topic that comes up a lot when discussing the Tea Party, you know, one of the most frequent charges that's leveled at the Tea Party and its members is that of racism. And you explain that dismissing the Tea Party as a white supremacist movement misses the complexity of how Tea Party members think about and talk about race. So what does a more nuanced examination of race and the Tea Party reveal?
This is an entire chapter in the book, and it was a challenging chapter to write. And I do have to give a shout out for some help I received on this, some guidance I received on this from Charles Price at the University of North Carolina, who's at Temple now. I found that saying that the Tea Party was motivated by racism as being much too simple. And one of the very curious things I found as I was doing my research was that at most of the Tea Party groups, at one point or another, they were very much brainstorming of how to attract more African Americans to the movement. In other words, they wanted blacks in the Tea Party and could not understand, and seriously could not understand, why they couldn't attract any. And this was a very curious thing, right? To say, well, you know, these are white supremacists, but they want to attract African Americans to the Tea Party. That's kind of a contradiction. What I argue in the book and from the data that I have was that the Tea Party is practicing a form of whiteness, and they're also practicing a form of colorblind racism. So the Tea Party is looking at the world through a conservative lens. Achievement, self-reliance, responsibility, the founding fathers. And so as we know that much of the disadvantage to people of color comes from structural factors, or structural power, even the power of hierarchy, the power of even things like implicit bias, or even the institutions that are reproduced in our society that reproduce racial and ethnic and gender oppression. So, in the Tea Party's world, they're not looking at the power of structure; they're looking at the individual. And so in their eyes, any individual should be able to live the American dream. So in a sense, that is inherently racist, because it is not taking into account the structural impediments to people of color in America. Now, the other point is that the Tea Party activists are emulating and celebrating the founding fathers. But at the same time, many of those founding fathers owned slaves. So the idea that these historical figures are paragons of virtue is contested in America, and not just by people of color, but also of white Americans also. So those are two points that I speak of in regard to how they are practicing a form of racism that is very subtle. And I'm not even we could call it racism. It's colorblind racism. But it's also an ignorance to the way that power operates in institutions and structures in America. I think I could go on a little bit more, but maybe you might have a follow-up for me, but I think I've answered that okay.
Well, it really is a rich chapter. I think there's a lot going on in there. And I think it's interesting when you talk about that moment on the street when an African-American woman walks by and you're there with people handing out Tea Party literature. And she says, I'm paraphrasing, but she basically says, I don't want it. I'm black. Right. And he says, oh, look, she thinks we're racist, and sort of finds that really amusing. And there's a disconnect there between that idea that if you're someone who doesn't commit overt acts of racism, you cannot be racist. And I like that you're bringing into the conversation other theoretical frameworks and other political frameworks for thinking about what racism looks like and how racism works, right, and adding them to this conversation.
Sorry. If I could make one point there about that instance that you're referencing, I want to make sure that people realize she thinks we're a bunch of freaking racists is what he said.
That's right.
Yes, he was amused, but he was also equally annoyed and angry, mm-hmm, because he felt that he was being unfairly labeled as a racist. So I want to make sure that it wasn't just like, she thinks we're racist. Ha ha ha. Right. No, it was, darn it. Why are these people thinking this of us? Right. So I just want to make sure that was clear.
Yeah. Thank you for that clarification. I do think that's important. No, you're also careful to delineate between the national Tea Party movement and the local Tea Party groups that you studied. So the local Tea Party groups, you argue, they served as communities of political practice. So I wondered if you could tell us a bit, what did those communities look like, and how did they vary across the different local groups that you studied?
The main way that I employ communities of political practice, and this is a concept by Jean Lave and Etienne Wenger called communities of practice. It was called situational learning. That's what the book was called. And the idea behind communities of practice is that people learn things by doing and watching and trying and having an experienced person overseeing and guiding through doing a novice person. And the Tea Party groups were not just areas where people got together and talked about the Constitution and Founding Fathers, but it was also a place where people learned how to be political activists. And some of the groups, not all of them, but some of the groups were just little beehives of political activity. There were so many activities going on, and people could get involved in them and they could learn. An example was public speaking. So if you were to go to what we call county commissioners here in California, their board of supervisors, the county legislative bodies, oftentimes you're allowed to do, I think they're 2 or 3 minute addresses to them at the beginning or the end of their sessions. And people started doing this at one of the groups, or several of the groups actually. And some people were absolutely terrified of standing up there and actually speaking, but they were helped along by others. And so they became fairly experienced people at speaking and also being pretty hard hitting in these things that they said. People learned how to leaflet and approach voters going into a polling booth, to give them a leaflet, to show them, give them suggestions for voting. So what I mean by these communities of practice, and I think this is what makes the local groups so important, is that they were spaces where people were learning how to be activists. They were schools of democratic process, basically, and which I think is important. People may disagree with what they were advocating, but these were places where people were learning how to be what Ralph Nader once said were full-time citizens, you know, and it was very, very interesting to watch them develop these skills of political organizing.
And what were some of the key tensions and differences you found that emerged both within specific local groups and then between different local Tea Party groups?
Two tensions that I outline in the book. One was actually in regard to religion. What was the place of religion in the Tea Party? This was a common tension that was present throughout the work, actually. Many of the people who were Tea Party activists were religious, were evangelicals. But it was almost like the cultural world of the Tea Party, you weren't supposed to have that. In other words, that wasn't part of the figured world of the Tea Party, was devout Christianity being brought into the political sphere. Now, people argued about that, but that was a common understanding that there isn't a place for that. But that tension was constantly there. And there was one group which was really quite remarkable. It was a man who was very religious, who actually had formed a Tea Party group that was more religious than Tea Party instead of the other way around. And this caused him to attract a very unique group of people who were very religious. But it also caused tension when new people would come in and think that they were joining a Tea Party group and actually seeing that it was more attuned to a church service. And so that was one of the tensions. Another tension was, how disruptive is a group going to be? Are we going to really confront the policymakers in our community about what they are doing about taxes or what have you, or not? And several of the groups were quite confrontational. But a couple of the other groups, the people, these were small southern towns, right? So people knew some of the people running the cities. And so the idea of them confronting these people that they're going to see at the grocery store, right, or who they went to high school with, was a little bit more difficult. So this group in particular did not get involved in much confrontational politics. They didn't get much involved in much politics at all because of this idea that they were offending people that they knew. One of the largest conflicts between groups, in other words, different local Tea Party groups, aside from the fact that they really couldn't come together to form a unified body of groups, they tried a couple of times and just each of them was different and they all liked their autonomy and what have you. But the other thing, after I finished my research, a lot of the groups had a huge fracture because of a primary election for, I believe it was for the Senate seat that was initially won by Tom Tillis in North Carolina. And there were two candidates. One was a very religious person and the other one was just a very conservative person. And both within the groups and between the groups, there were huge fissures where people stopped talking to each other and groups stopped communicating with each other, because they were supporting these two different candidates. Interestingly, they both lost. You know, they got Tom Tillis, which none of them supported. So that was another one of the tensions that was going on.
Well, you also describe the difference between the groups that functioned as audiences for the National Tea Party movement and those that functioned more as activists. And I wonder if you could explain what that difference is and how it manifested in terms of the differences between those local groups.
Right. The two primary activities that happened in the local Tea Party group meetings were planning political activities, engaging in political activities, and listening to speakers come and talk about things. And these could have been speakers from local organizations. They could have been candidates coming to seek support. They could have been some of the larger Tea Party groups, like a representative from Americans for Prosperity or Freedom Works, which were large national level Tea Party groups. And what I found is that in some of the groups in 2010, but all of the groups did some type of political activity. They either went out and you know, leafleted or did phone banks for candidates or something. All of the groups did something in 2010. But after 2010, the energy started waning, and many of the groups stopped doing outside activist work, but they continued to meet. And they were meeting, and they were meeting for the chance to hear these speakers come. And as a result, they were what I termed audience groups. And then several of the other groups continued to do very active organizing. I think there were four or five groups that were really quite effective and quite active. And I called those activist groups. And the point that I make in the book is that even though they were different and only one group might have been actually confronting, like we see the Tea Party doing, they were nonetheless people coming together and learning about issues, right? And seeing their own efficacy as you know, people that politicians are going to come and address. So people were still becoming informed voters in the audience groups and not doing much activism. In the other groups, they were involved in activism. And I want to make the point that though the activist groups were probably a bit more interesting and probably a little bit more effective, that there was still things going on in groups that were not visible and probably were not being paid attention to by groups. But if somebody wanted to draw upon a large group of high propensity voters, go to a Tea Party group. Even if they're not doing activism, there's a whole bunch of very conservative people that are going to listen to you. So those were still important spaces for people to be involved with, and important for the movement in general.
Well, and following on that, you do note that, especially I think the activist groups, many of them developed new sets of grievances, some of which fell outside the original Tea Party focus on taxes and spending. And I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about some examples of these new grievances.
Some of them were understandable. For instance, the Second Amendment. You know, Second Amendment is part of the right to bear arms, is part of the Constitution. So that's something that people are going to feel very strongly about. And it became almost a badge of membership to get a conceal and carry license, which is a license to carry a concealed firearm. And they have classes. I'm not sure if they do these all over the country, but here in the South, it's a very common thing for people to be carrying weapons, carrying concealed weapons. And that was one of the changes that nobody ever really talked about, that, you know, as one of the Tea Party's main points, but it became one in the groups. Many people started to get conceal and carry license. Some people didn't want them. And that was one of the tensions, I think, that was in one group that I know of. The most interesting was, and I outline in a later chapter of the book, is the organizing around what's called Agenda 21. This is a body of guidelines that was created from the Rio Climate Summit in the 90s. And it's a guideline for local governments in how to become more sustainable. And Agenda 21 today is seen as a conspiracy to take people's liberty and freedom away by, you know, making them live in condensed housing near, you know, rail lines, for instance, or things like that. That it's an infringement on their freedom. But when I started my research, nobody was talking about it. And a person in one of the groups started talking about it, and people thought he was kind of nutty for bringing up this conspiracy. But what was really interesting was that there were people starting to talk about it in other groups too. And it was not being talked about on the media, on Fox or in the media rather, on Fox or Glenn Beck, even Glenn Beck, who peddles in conspiracy theories. It wasn't even mentioned, but it started to bubble up from the Tea Party groups, this idea of Agenda 21 being a plot. And eventually the larger organizations noticed this bubbling up from the grassroots and they appropriated it. And then it started circulating there. And so it was something that actually started with the Tea Party and moved out into the wider conservative network. And to a degree where it was actually put into the platform at the Republican National Committee in 2000, I don't know, 12 or 14 or something. So this is another point that I want to make. When people talk about the Tea Party, they think that the people are sort of automatons that are blindly listening to Glenn Beck and Fox News and just following orders. When in reality, these local groups were vibrant. They were sites of cultural production where people were developing new grievances that were then fed back into the movement, into the network of movements that made up the Tea Party. So, political actors act. Right? People who are involved in politics act. They take what they learn and they respond to it and they socialize with it and they use it. Right? It's not just that people are being told what to do politically.
Well, and I think following on that, you're right that social movements like the Tea Party, in addition to media and online sources, that they're really changing the structural characteristics of American institutional politics and sort of resulting in this political culture in which political parties no longer have the power to conceptualize, focus, or even respond to the broad ideological terrain of American political culture. And I thought that was a really powerful statement you make. And what do you see as the implications of this new structure?
I'm not hopeful. I stand behind what I wrote, but I'm still thinking through this because it's kind of an area of research that I'm doing right now. We can talk about later. But I think we see this happening with Donald Trump, because most of the Republican, we're seeing this with the impeachment that's going on, is all the Republicans have pretty much fallen in line behind Trump. But they didn't at the beginning when he was running. And it seems that the Republican Party is really irrelevant today. It's this group, this what they're calling the base, which is being motivated through social media and through Trump's Twitter feed and through social media and broadcast media. And a lot of the issues are being developed and circulated in that way. So the political party, the Republican Party, to me, doesn't seem to exist anymore. There was no way that here in South Carolina, the former governor, Mark Sanford, was going to run for president, but they wouldn't even let him. They wouldn't even open the primary. They canceled the primary because they didn't want Trump to have any opposition. So I think the parties really have become irrelevant. Now, what are the implications? I said I'm not hopeful because I think that the media architecture that we have today, the bubbles and the echo chambers that exist, are very dangerous for democracy. And I think that people are not practicing our democracy has changed, and people are not practicing partisanship in regard to these are the things that I believe in as a Republican or a Democrat. Oftentimes what people are doing today is saying, what I believe is that I don't believe in those people over there. Those people are bad or evil or sick or something like that. And I think that's one of the repercussions of this media-driven political culture that we have today. I might have gone off your question a little bit, but I think that answers it to a degree.
Well, that's great. And I think you answered the next one I would have asked, right? Which is sort of about how Tea Partyists responded to Trump. And I think you sort of spoke to that.
Yes. I was actually surprised. I'm actually writing a piece for, it's called an afterword or a coming back to an article I wrote for the Political and Legal Anthropology Review. They've asked me to write an epilogue, basically, to the article I wrote a couple of years ago, and I'm writing that right now. In how did my Tea Party supporters become such strong Trump supporters? And late in 2016, early 2017, I didn't think that my Tea Party supporters were going to support Trump, because I didn't think Trump was the political fundamentalist and the founding father, supporting candidate. So I didn't think my Tea Party people were going to fall in line, but they all did. And this is one of the questions that I'm pursuing and writing about right now. And part of it comes back to that idea of right-wing populism and stigma that I mentioned a few minutes ago. And so those are the links I see are that there's a commonality in right-wing populism that has made these two groups come together. And the other fact is that the Tea Party pretty much declined. There are only a couple of groups that are still meeting regularly. So for all intents and purposes, a lot of those local groups have ceased to function. And a lot of the national Tea Party groups have become very strong Trump supporting groups also.
I really appreciate your giving our listeners such a full sense of the book and its arguments, both its arguments about the Tea Party movement, but also about their broader implications as you've been speaking to. And I wanted to ask, as you look back, what was the hardest part of writing this book?
I think the hardest part was the race chapter, I think, because I knew that was going to possibly rub some people the wrong way. And I had to make sure that I was not being necessarily an apologist for the movement, but trying to be as objective as I could. So that was a difficult one. And there's a place there where I contradict a couple of scholars who have written on race and the Tea Party. That's not something I do a lot. So I was a little uncomfortable, calling out another scholar in a book. I mean, I wasn't harsh about it. I said, this is what I disagree with. But that was, that was a little difficult to do also. So those were the main things about that chapter, because I knew it was going to possibly make some people angry. Some people disagree with me. But I also have gotten some very positive feedback from people on that chapter. So I think it's probably the one I'm the most proud of in the book, I think.
Well, then conversely, what was your favorite part of the book to write?
My favorite part was the personal paths that people took to the Tea Party. All of these stories that people told me, that they willingly told me. I mean, I really didn't have to pull things out of them. And I heard these just wonderful stories of how people were linking their political identity to childhood or family history or jobs they had done or something that happened in their childhood. And it was, I found it just fascinating. And I could have written another, 20 pages on that, I think, because the data was just so rich that people gave me. I mean, just to give you an example, because we were just talking about race, oftentimes there were several times when I started my interview, and before I even asked a question, somebody would tell me about their family history, and they would always go back to the Civil War, and I had several people tell me that, well, my family, North Carolina was very torn on joining the Confederacy. It was one of the last states to join, and Western North Carolina was never really that loyal to the Confederacy. So I had several of my consultants say, well, my family were were Republicans. We didn't support slavery. We didn't support the Confederacy. So it's almost they were confronting this racism charge right up front by talking about their family history of not being part of the Confederacy. So that's one example. But it was really the data was really fun. I really enjoyed some of these conversations. And I think it's one of the great things about being an anthropologist is being able to sit down and hear these ways that people see the world that are so rich and nuanced. It was great.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, I agree on both fronts. I love that part of the book. And also I love that ethnography allows us that as researchers and as readers. I think that's my favorite part about it. If readers take home only one thing from your book, what would you want it to be?
That we should look at people's political outlooks as nuanced and as complex and as interesting, and that we need to not assume that because somebody is holding positions that are different than us, that they are less smart or less caring or less human or what have you. That typically, if we want to understand why people do things politically, we have to dig a little deeper and understand where they're coming from. And I personally believe that anthropologists have not been good at this in regard to conservatives. This book, as far as I know, is the only book on the Tea Party that's been written by an anthropologist. And I don't think, while I kind of like cornering the market, I don't think that's right. I think there should be more anthropologists that are engaging with the right wing and trying to understand it. Because that's how we're going to understand the position that our country and the world actually is in right now, is through understanding where people's political outlooks are coming from, what their history is, what they're afraid of, what they're angry about. And these, they're different, but everybody has them. Everybody has them.
Thank you, Bill. It's been a real pleasure talking with you today. And before I let you go, I wondered if you could tell me, what do you think your next project will be?
I am doing a couple of things. First, I want to use a little bit more of the Tea Party data to, one, write on the Tea Party as becoming Trump supporters. And then two, I've also not read much on how conservatives visualize environmentalism. And there was the Agenda 21 situation that I talked about a few minutes ago uncovered some interesting ways that conservatives look at nature and land and the way that humans look at nature. And I want to do a little bit more on that. The next project is going to be difficult and it's going to take some time, but I am most concerned about the dramatic changes in American political culture just over the last couple of years. I think that we have seen with not just with Trump, but it's been made much more salient with Trump, but also I think even going back to some of the things that Mitch McConnell has done. Our political culture, in other words, how we operate as a democracy, both institutionally and in the public, is based on a culture that is very fragile. And I never realized how fragile this culture is. In other words, how easily it can be disrupted and how things that were not sayable or doable just a few months ago are now sayable and doable. And how things can be that we take for being, you know, important aspects of our political culture can be just ignored. I got to thinking about this when the Senate refused to take up Barack Obama's choice for Supreme Court at the end of his term, when they didn't take up and they waited until the election. And they were within their rights to do it, but it was something that should not have happened. And I was very struck by how easy it was for them to change something that was so fundamental in American democracy. So my next project is to do something more expansive on the political culture and how it's shifting dramatically and how fragile that political culture actually is. And that I don't think we realized how fragile our political culture is until just within the last couple of years, I think.
No, I think that will be a fascinating book to write and a fascinating book to read. So I will look forward to you writing it and me reading it when you've done all the heavy lifting. So thank you again, Bill, for talking with me today. I've really appreciated it and enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it too. Thank you very much.
This is Carrie Lane, a host of New Books in American Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. You've been listening to my interview with Bill Westermeyer, author of Back to America: Identity, Political Culture, and the Tea Party Movement.